In his discussions about Earth evolution, Steiner is at pains to describe the way in which the number seven figures again and again, that there are going to be seven planetary rounds. So though we speak of Earth evolution, that's in part because we're on the Earth. The Earth is the fourth of these seven. And the middle point of Earth evolution, where, as Steiner describes, and we will hear more about this soon, the Christ being appears, this is also the precise middle of this whole evolutionary stage, that there will be in the future three more planetary rounds, which will, again, present completely different circumstances and different challenges and completely different states of being. And Steiner gives these, again, planetary names: Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan. Very interesting that the term Vulcan is used, which is generally not recognized as a planet, but somehow strangely made its way in the incredibly popular TV show Star Trek. So we are right in the middle, basically, of that. Also points out that on the Earth itself, there will be seven major periods, of which we are in one. We spoke earlier of the recapitulations of the Saturn stage, the Sun stage, the Moon stage. So we had their Hyperborea, Polaria, Lemuria, Atlantis. So there we have four, and we are in the post-Atlantean age, of which there will be, there have been four, and there will be three more to go. We are in the fifth post-Atlantean age. This is the only time that Steiner describes that we are, as it were, a little bit beyond the middle. Because he said that as an initiate, the initiate can, as it were, is granted to see what took place in the past up to a certain point and what will take place in the future up to an exactly balancing point. It's like being on a mountain with an unobstructed view. It may be that you can see 50 miles to the north. You'll also then see 50 miles to the south, 50 miles to the east and west. The same with present and future for the initiate. He is poised in a certain kind of time continuum, which is like being at the peak of a mountain, and he therefore can see certain distance ahead, a certain distance below. So the initiate is always going to tell us we're right in the middle, and that's sort of where we are. So the first four epochs Steiner speaks of as ancient India, ancient Persia, and then one that's a kind of configuration, a confluence of several, ancient Mesopotamia, Babylonia, and Egypt. And then what he speaks of as the Greco-Roman epoch, which includes the development of ancient Greece, and the unfolding of Rome, the Roman Empire. And this then takes us right up through the Middle Ages, that Steiner says really the life of Rome and the sense of being a Roman persisted in Europe throughout, for example, the Holy Roman Empire, which didn't dissolve until 1806, that there was a feeling throughout the Middle Ages that people were citizens of Rome, not of any particular nation. And that brings us then up to our time, the fifth post-Atlantean period, which we would call the modern age, or perhaps the age of the consciousness soul, very strongly characterized by the influence of Europe throughout the world, for good and for ill. Now, These epochs, the way Steiner describes them, were particularly like a smaller recapitulation of the general planetary movements, which is to say, again and again, there was a sort of outbreathing, expansive quality, and then a contracting, breathing in. There was a longing, a connection with the spiritual world, and then there was an attraction to the earthly world, a coming in. We could say that it's as though Luciferic and Ahrimanic forces, as I've described them earlier, kept working in tandem, though primarily, as I have mentioned, from the ancient Indian time through the middle of the Greco-Roman time, Luciferic forces ruled most strongly. They were dominant. There's one thing Steiner tells us about Lucifer, which is very interesting. He says that one of Lucifer's evils, one of his vices, is vanity. Lucifer is incredibly vain. And above all, he loves to see his own image, graven or otherwise. And for this reason, Lucifer and the host of beings working with Lucifer made sure that from early on, they began to teach human beings how to represent things artistically. And above all, how to represent divine beings, gods and goddesses, artistically. Because in one way or another, this were sort of the many faces, the many masks of Lucifer. And this way he could see himself again and again and again. And if you think of how often in ancient art, you know, maybe you'll walk a long processional walkway and you'll see sphinx upon sphinx upon sphinx. Or you will see in temple drawings the same god and goddess again and again and again. Repetitive images of these divine beings. This is Luciferic through and through. But we also might have to say, thank you, Lucifer, for encouraging people to do this because, number one, it's given us about 90% of the greatest art that we have on earth comes from these Luciferic times. It's given us some of the most enduring work because these temples were built to really, really last. Of course, we can think of the Sphinx and the pyramids. It's even hard for art historians and geologists to agree about how old they are. Their provenance is so ancient. And there they are, still standing in relatively good shape. This was Lucifer's power. Though Percy Bysshe Shelley, in his wonderful poem Ozymandias, pictures such a Luciferic monument crumbling into the very desert sand from which it arose. Yes, a lot of it is gone, and we'll never know how much there was, but it's remarkable how much has persisted and how much it tells us about the beliefs, the customs, the modes of worship, the consciousness of these ancient people. Now, Steiner stresses, interestingly enough, and this is something that is generally ignored by Waldorf teachers who are not given this actually in their training. And this is very important. He says that when he speaks of ancient India, it is ancient India before a single temple was ever built. It's an ancient India before anybody sculpted anything. It's an ancient India in which people are still basically living half in the spiritual world and half on earth. They did not need anything to remind them, to memorialize their spiritual experiences. They were having these spiritual experiences. He says the same thing is basically true about what he means by ancient Persia, what he means by ancient Assyria, Babylon, Egypt, and so on. Only when he begins to speak about the Greek times is he starting to touch on an epoch in which, yes, there already were buildings, there already was some statuary and so on. So Steiner's picture of these cultures is, as it were, the time in which that culture is still in a kind of pre-cultural formation, certainly a prehistorical stage. And what we get in terms of the great artworks of these cultures is only the residue. It's only a bit of what finally precipitated out of what had been a very, very lively, bubbling, burbling sort of existence. So this is yet another one of these tensions between what Steiner says about something and what we can verify historically or as an evolution at large scientifically as well. So let's just sort of take some of the grand gestures. Ancient India, as Steiner describes it, was a breathing out time. He said that here those tribes, those groups, those oracular societies that had taken the long, long journey in which undoubtedly many generations passed and perished, they came now finally to a place whose climate, whose liveliness was somewhat almost Lemurian in nature. And for them now, it was a great breathing out. They said that physical matter was Maya, and though they could sense that they were losing the old clairvoyance, in which the gods were simply present for them all the time, through exercises in breath control, that which has come to be called yoga, though in our time it's a very weak image of the powerful spiritual experiences they could evoke, through breathing exercises they were able to, as it were, while still in a physical state, completely exhale themselves into the spiritual world and exist there much more than they really did on the earth. But from the intermediate stage, we also see a pattern that we see repeated again and again in all of the cultural epochs that Steiner mentions, which is a battle. That before the Atlanteans could fully assume rulership of this new land to which they came, the Indian land, they had to battle. And with whom did they battle? They battled with the descendants of the Lemurians who were already living there. Now, we can speak a lot about modern colonialism and imperialism and all of the havoc that we have wreaked, in a way, in the cultures of the world. But we have to realize that the seemingly indigenous peoples of India themselves overcame, and we might say colonialized, or at least even completely exterminated, many who were already living there. And we see this particularly in the epic of the Ramayana, the story of Ram, the great avatar of the god Vishnu, who must overcome especially those societies, those groups, those tribes still living in the area of today's Sri Lanka, who are represented as having tremendous demonic forces, who, for example, are able to produce beings who are huge in size and superhuman in strength. Ravana, the demon with many, 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 many arms, who's able to hurl multiple weapons, sounds like the sort of thing that probably the armed forces in the U.S. are trying to produce in laboratories nowadays. These were beings who had the power of Lemuria, who still carried these kind of meteorological and geological forces in their own organism, and who had to be overcome by completely new forms of consciousness. A different kind of god and goddess had to come to the aid of those in India. And then we see this kind of epoch and epic activity in the stories from Persia, where Zarathustra finds a connection with the god of light, Ahura Mazda, and where Zarathustra's people, the Iranians, as they're more often than not called in Waldorf schools today, actually that is a kind of corruption of their actual name, which was Aryans. They were the Aryans, and they fought against the Turanians. The Aryans lived in the light, the Turanians in the darkness. The Aryans learned, because this was a kind of contraction epoch in which they became very interested in the earth and worked on the earth, the Aryans learned how to use the plow and farm the earth. They learned from Zarathustra how to domesticate the wild animals, how to gather the seeds of the wild grasses and turn them into the grains and so on. So we see now an epoch that even modern archaeology and anthropology would certainly acknowledge was there, and they would say that Zarathustra is like a composite of all of those ingenious human beings over thousands of years who began to figure out how to start to settle down. But nonetheless, here again, there is this battle between those living in light and those living in darkness who cannot bear the light of the sun. This brings us back to those figures who kind of held on to the light for themselves in a selfish way back in old sun evolution, and then come again in a troublesome way on the moon, and then finally in Lemuria. So again, another pitched battle. And now in Persia, the attention is very, very much directed to things of the earth. And though there are a multiplicity of gods and goddesses, the god of the sun, Ahura Mazda, starts to assume a particularly important role. He's definitely first among equals in the songs of Zarathustra, the teachings of that time. And then we go on to those peoples gathered further west, and you notice we're moving from east to west for sure. This is very much Steiner's orientation. And now we come to the great civilizations of Assyria, Mesopotamia, and finally Egypt. And here Steiner says there's another expansion, only they cannot expand nearly as far as the ancient Indians did. Here, they can only go as far as the visible cosmos. And this is why the Assyrians in particular become master astronomers and develop the ziggurat, a kind of astronomical observatory for the first time. They divide the sky into 360 degrees and make remarkably accurate astronomical observations and have a deep understanding then of the harmony between the stars, the visible stars, which is to say the working of the highest hierarchies, and what is meant to occur on Earth. And here we find the remarkable structuring of earthly society. And we find, in a way, the first real leaders of earthly culture with their virtues and their vices. And Steiner pointed particularly to Gilgamesh. And it must be said that the Epic of Gilgamesh had only really come into the Western world a short time before Steiner was speaking about it. He said this is a very important document for Westerners to understand. For this epic is not about a great pitched battle between one group of less clairvoyant humans and another more atavistically clairvoyant, but rather it is an epic basically about one human being, this very, very flawed ruler, Gilgamesh, his love for his bosom companion, Ebani or Enkidu, and his battle with the goddess of, we could say, something like the Venus figure of that ancient civilization, Ishtar. So this is a very different picture. On the one hand, we're talking about a very cosmically inclined people, but we're also speaking here about the very beginnings, the tiniest seeds of human introspection, and the beginning of the asking of the most existential question of all: why do human beings die? So we see Gilgamesh is an advanced, highly developed member of his culture precisely because he is so disconnected from the spiritual world. It's not obvious to him anymore that death is just another way of relating to the earth and the world of the spirit. For him, this is a completely different state of being. It is one of darkness, it's one of uncertainty, and it even makes the whole meaning of earthly life darker and more uncertain. So with this figure, we really begin to see evolution starting to turn away from being an outer, external experience, or rather an experience in which the human being is simply embedded in the evolving and changing world, and one in which the individual must start to come to terms with his or her own responsibility in evolution. And it is at this point that we can begin to speak of a certain changing in the way in which the most developed human beings relate to the spiritual world. The falling away of the old clairvoyant state, what is going to replace it? From whence will human beings receive the wisdom, the direction that they need to be able to move forward? Because now human culture is getting ever more orderly and organized. Still, the memories are there because these are still the descendants of the more highly developed Atlanteans. The memory is there of a way of organizing society. But how will this come about? In Atlantis, the organization was completely a priestly matter. The oracles were those who saw fully and directly into the spiritual world. This is no longer going to be possible on the earth. That now the priestly connection must slowly but surely start to give way to another kind of human being who stands at the forefront of his culture and relates to the spiritual world differently. So in our next segment, we are going to look at the change in the course of initiation that these cultural epochs and their development necessitate, and how this bears tremendous consequences for us human beings on the earth today.